As Ari mentioned, I want to deal with two topics which we have not really touched on in these last few days. And I want to emphasize the revolutionary effects of archaeology. That archaeology has an effect is ipso facto the case. Whenever you bring new data, new information, so you have an effect. You add information. You tell us something new. But I want to emphasize the word revolutionary. And that term is what mandated my choosing of these two instances. I'm taking one, trying to be very balanced, somewhere between Bush and Kerry, very balanced. Not like what I heard on the news this morning about Edwards. My God, one channel absolutely roasted him, and the other channel was radio station, was very positive. So, any case, one example would be from the diaspora, the other from Judea, and the term Judea was the name of Israel in the late Second Temple period, before it changed its name, or the Romans changed its name, to Palestina, or Syria-Palestina, in the year 135. One example will be one which we know a lot about. We have lots of information. And yet archaeology has come and turned things drastically around. The other example, we have nothing. And the archaeological remains are stunning and raise as many questions as they answer. The first has to do with Herod, the king of Judea, and the second with Dura Europus, a synagogue found on the Euphrates River today in eastern Syria. So let's start with number one, Herod. That's obviously Judea, and a person about whom we know a great deal, primarily from Josephus. The first century Jewish historian Josephus spends a lot of time, both in his book, The War of the Jews, and especially in his later book, The Antiquities of the Jews, spelling out Herod's career. We also know a little bit from rabbinic literature, not much, and a little bit from the New Testament as well. The image of Herod that has reigned for 2,000 years up until the mid 20th century was a negative image. He was pictured as a half-Jew. He was pictured as extremely cruel and bloodthirsty, of which Josephus does talk about that. He does mention, especially within when he came to power. There's an interesting statement made by Renan, a 19th century historian, that Herod came to rule like a fox, he ruled like a lion, and he died like a dog. Very sick at the end of his days, physically, emotionally, and in the first part, in the last part of his life, there was a lot of shedding of blood. This image is especially emphasized and certainly has penetrated Western culture because, go back to our first session together on Thursday, because of the Gospel of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew depicting Herod as hearing about a savior or a king or somebody being born in Bethlehem, and he had all the young boys, babies, killed in order to wipe out any potential threat. And that image, certainly in medieval Christian art, has one that's dominated the consciousness in Western society of a very, very negative image. I am not going to claim that he was a saint. But what I am going to suggest is the picture is far more complex, and the information and the insights that we have in the last generation or two indicate a need for a lot more balance in trying to understand Herod and what he was all about. Why this change? First of all, there is a recognition that the sources, many of the sources that blacken his image, are tendentious. They are not historical fact. They are written from whatever point of view and really express a certain political, religious point of view that may or may not be historically accurate. And the best example I go back is to what we spoke about on Thursday with the Gospel of Matthew. If the author of the Gospel of Matthew wanted to picture Jesus as a second Moses, then he used Herod as a second Pharaoh. And he attributed to Herod things that are known about Pharaoh in the book of Exodus. That's what I mean by tendentious. He has another agenda, and he opposes that agenda and uses Herod, just like he uses other things, in order to get that agenda across. Two, comparative speaking. To the extent that he was cruel, he probably was a very, very tough leader and at times cruel. When you look around in contemporary society, most people were like that. Most kings were like that. Most emperors were like that. People didn't achieve political power in antiquity without shedding blood and without a certain degree, modicum, of cruelty. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to look at Hellenistic Roman society and Jewish society as well. If you go back and read some of the stories about the Hasmoneans beforehand, before Herod, there's a lot of cruelty that goes on there. As a matter of fact, we even mentioned that at one point. They also crucified Alexander Yanai, crucified his enemies, not to speak of exiling them, punishing them, and other things. So in other words, cruelty was not the hallmark only of Herod. That's the way it is, and therefore some perspective has to be given. The third is a willingness of people to make a distinction between private and public. In other words, Herod may have been rather cruel in coming to rule, but especially afterwards, especially in the sickness, dealing with his family. The question is, when judging Herod, should one make a distinction between public and private? In other words, you want to judge, is it legitimate? And I ask this as a question. Is it legitimate to say, let's talk about Herod as a leader, as a king? What he does in private, that's something else. An interesting discussion I had yesterday with some people who are sitting here, so I don't know if I'll embarrass them, so I won't mention names. But before that, I remember back in 1958, I think it was, about 3 days before a very important election, which is supposed to be Nelson Rockefeller's stepping stone to the presidency, perhaps, or at least to, as a candidate, 1960. 3 days before the election in New York, he was divorced. And that sealed his fate. All right? No question back there. It's private and it's public, and let's judge a man by the politics. And so the discussion we had yesterday, someone also made the statement that whatever Bill Clinton did, all right, that's private and there's a public thing, but the private thing was offensive because it wasn't the Oval Office. It wasn't the White House. It was in this, and he should have known better, etc. In other words, these issues of public and private and where exactly are there. So the question is, how much do we want to judge Herod as a leader, as a political, not as a human being, not as a religious man, not as a moral figure, etc., but as a king, how much is it legitimate to divorce the private from the public and judge him on that basis, and to the extent to which people do it, you get a different image of Herod. And finally, there's the archaeology. I guess you didn't know where we're going. Now we're coming to archaeology, all right? There's no doubt that the catalyst for rethinking this was the archaeology, finding in the mid-20th, late 20th century, all the incredible buildings that Herod erected. He was a builder. If they said about his patron, Augustus, that he founded this Rome of stone and left it a city of marble, Herod did much the same thing. His building was ambitious. There's nothing, when Herod wanted to build something, topography didn't matter. He would change the topography. He did it in Jerusalem with a temple. He did it in Caesarea. He did it in Masada. A man with grandiose vision and ability to mobilize and carry it out. Some of the building was private for his own and his family. Others were public for especially his capital city, Jerusalem, and for other cities in his kingdom. The Pièce de Résistance, of his building was, of course, the temple in Jerusalem, which he totally refashioned, doubled the size of the temple. Whatever it had been from Solomon through the Hasmoneans, he now doubled its size, built a humongous temple mount, which served as the forum, the agora, the main public space, not only of the Jews who lived in Jerusalem, but for all the Jews in Judea. Every important national institution, whether it's judicial, whether it was the various sects and study, whether it was social, whether it was political, and certainly religious, and social as well, meetings, all took place on the Temple Mount. And in the center of the Temple Mount was the temple itself. It was a Temple Mount. Was a huge area. By the way, the largest podium, artificial podium, that was known in the Roman East. And here was the temple and its courtyards. But all around was used for the other purposes, which I have just noted. And what is interesting is that Herod, with one exception, and I'll ask you if anybody knows what that one exception, was very punctilious in not offending or transgressing Jewish custom, Jewish law of the time. For example, when people wanted to marry in to his family, the larger family which he controlled, the male had to be circumcised. Otherwise, he would not permit the marriage. Mikvaot, ritual baths, multiplied at that time because of the grandeur of the temple and the need to bring pure, unadulterated, undefiled food into this area. We find hundreds of mikvaot in archaeological remains. The art, whether it's in his private home or publicly, all followed what was then the normative practice among Jews, then, not before and not after. We talked about the pendulum a little bit of not showing figural art. Okay, that was accepted among the Jews for about 300 years, a total avoidance of any figural art, be it of animals, humans, and certainly any kind of mythological figure. Here, there was one exception. Does anybody know what it is?
The eagle.
The eagle. All right. There is a story of Herod putting up an eagle on one of the gates of the temple or the Temple Mount, which caused a mini riot, which he, as is his way, put down quickly and effectively. And that is a strange story. Generally, it's assumed, but it's hard to tell from Josephus's formulation, that that may have been one of the things he did at the end of his life, because that's where it's reported, at the very end of his life. And he was really just not all with it. All right, and he did something that, with a little bit more sanity and a little bit more control that he had for decades before, probably would not have been done. But that is a major exception. Also, Herod was very active, not only in promoting his own kingdom, but also helping diaspora communities. We hear about issues between the diaspora Jewish communities and the cities in which they resided. Why were there issues? Because the Jews had a hell of a lot of privileges, and it was resented. The Jews sent their money to Jerusalem. It was resented, taking silver out of the province. The Jews didn't have to show up in law courts on Shabbat. It was resented. The Jews didn't worship the gods of the cities. It was resented. The Jews had to have their own mini community and judicial institutions. That was resented. The Jews didn't have to serve in the Roman legion. That was resented. Right? So there were reasons for the resentment. There was this tension between diaspora, many diaspora communities, and their surrounding cities. And when cities tried to eliminate Jewish rights or infringe upon Jewish rights, the Jews turned to Herod and to try to intercede with the Romans, because the Romans are the ones that are in control, to restore their rights, maintain their rights, which Herod did. In other words, if we take these things that I mentioned, rereading Josephus in the light that he may not have been the ugly, evil personality that some sources portray, one can really say that Herod perhaps had a vision. He was not just king. And his vision was to integrate, to incorporate his kingdom into the Pax Romana. What's the Pax Romana? The Roman peace. The vision of Virgil in the Aeneid, that Rome will rule for a millennium and there will be peace. That was the vision of Herod's day. That was the vision of Augustus. That was the vision that was foremost in the Roman world. Herod bought into it. And he saw the future of his kingdom, if you wish, the Jews, as being part and parcel of the Pax Romana. And that meant politically, loyalty, cooperation. It meant also culturally. Not at the expense of Judaism. He built a temple. Not at the expense of Judaism, but to enhance it by being a part of that. So let's take a look at the page that you have, which in this has these three. I'm really sorry. I wish I could say that the Xerox machine in Jerusalem is better, but it ain't. But in any case, what I'm going to do, however, is pass around the more or less the originals of what I show you, so at least you can get a sense and try not to study it for too long. There are a lot of people who want to see it. Let's take a look at these three things, and I'll try to describe, certainly number one, what you see. The first is, and this is again, how archaeology highlights the cultural integration of Herod's kingdom in the larger world. And here I must, 30-second pause for commercial. Not really. The Jews, remember, those of you who were here a couple of days ago, Saturday it was. I said that the Jews rarely have their own unique institutions, buildings, whether it's a temple or a synagogue. A lot of it's been adopted and adapted. The same thing goes with material culture. And the Jews really never had their buildings that are strictly, uniquely Jewish, or a general architecture that is strictly Jewish or uniquely Jewish that they came up with. They never had it. Not in the beginning, and we use the example of Solomon and the temple, Herod and his temple. The Jews used models from the world around, just as they did with the synagogue, and we've talked about that. By the way, it shouldn't surprise you. You have a great campus here, but I can't exactly call this building Jewish architecture, nor the JCC that I was overwhelmingly impressed with yesterday, Jewish architecture, except for the Kotel, few wall stones of Jerusalem. Okay, that's kind of a token of this. And as Ari pointed out, a library, Jewish library, that's not even there as well. So, but that's, your homes. I've been to many lovely homes in this community, or a number of, I should say, many. And they were homes like every other home. All right? Not that there's some difference. There's a mezuzah, and there's this. And that, but I'm talking about the architecture in this. So material culture the Jews always borrowed. They always borrowed. All right? A small people, whatever was the regnant styles, is what they adopted and used, with certain adjustments made, particularly in the internal side. So the archaeology emphasizes this. That's why in archaeology, you usually talk about the periods not as the Second Temple period or the Talmudic period or this. You call it the Persian period, the Hellenistic period, the Roman period, the Byzantine period, because that is what shaped the archaeology, the use of material culture, the synchronic, the horizontal influences on the Jews. And therefore, let's take a look and see how it's expressed in Jerusalem. And of course here, well, we'll see. The one at the very top, and it's hard to read, and is probably the most important inscription found in Jerusalem at this period. It's all in Greek. All right, it's an inscription which dedicates a synagogue. All right, a synagogue by a family or a man called Theodotus, the son of Vatenus. Theodotus is a Greek name, Vatenus a Roman name, who is an archi-synagogus, again, a term widely used, like president of a synagogue or something like that, widely used in the non-Jewish world. And he was the son of a archi-synagogus and the grandson of a guy. Looks like it was a family business, at least for a couple of generations. And what's interesting is what was the function of this particular synagogue, a place of reading the Torah, practicing the mitzvot, and as a hostel, as a place where people can stay, obviously, when they come to visit the temple. Now, this emphasizes what I had mentioned, I think at one other time, that how much Greek was known and spoken in Jerusalem. It was not the most, it was a multilingual society. The most spoken language was what?
Aramaic.
Then came Greek, and a distant third and even more distant fourth was Hebrew and Latin. But Greek, 37% of the inscriptions that we have in Jerusalem, from Jerusalem, are in Greek. And when you remember that most of those inscriptions are funerary inscriptions, burial inscriptions. So the inclination maybe of using Hebrew, the holy tongue in a grave or near a grave, one would think maybe that would increase the Hebrew. Whatever the case is, 37% is in Greek. If you look down at the next, you see the hippodrome. This is a... for horse chariot races. By the way, this is taken from, anybody know where? The Holy Land model, all right? Really a must, I'm sure. How many of you have been to the Holy Land in Jerusalem? Very nice. All right, and anyone who goes to Jerusalem, really, unless you're terribly busy with negotiations, political, and with Knesset meetings, you know, the AIPAC shtick, unless you're doing that, you have some time, somewhere in the top 10 places. That was good. I didn't say the most important. I didn't. All right? The top 10 places, you ought to go see that. It's a brilliant, brilliant, imaginative, in the best sense of the word, imaginative replica of what Jerusalem might have looked like in the time of Herod and afterwards. And what is interesting, Herod's Jerusalem. Now, you people are, about Orange County, but certainly if you take the greater Los Angeles, any city in America, to be serious, has to have certain institutions. You have to have a theater, an orchestra, you have to have a museum, and of course you have to have sports arenas, etc. Well, in the Roman city, there was a requirement for at least three such institutions. A theater for dramatic presentation, a hippodrome for chariot races, or a smaller version of the hippodrome would be the stadium for foot races. The stadium is about 200 yards long, and a hippodrome is 300-400 yards, but the same idea. And the third is the amphitheater for bloody spectacles, gladiators, animals, etc. Those are the three institutions. Rome had them, Antioch, Alexandria, Caesarea had it, Jerusalem had it. In other words, Herod built these institutions together with a temple. All right? But these are institutions that he wanted to be in Jerusalem so that Jerusalem would be a Jewish but Roman city in all senses of the word. Finally, the last example is a fascinating one. Whether Herod initiated it or just part of the ambience. Of the society at that time. This is a small stone chest. Okay? Does anybody know what it was used for? Anybody know what it's called?
Ossuaries.
Very good. Ossuaries. Yeah. All right? Small stone chest for burying, gathering bones. And here we have a fascinating thing. No Jew would do this today. No Jew would do this the last 2,000 years. No Jew would have done this before Herod. What is this custom? The custom is that you bury someone, and after, I'm sorry to be a little morbid, but just to get this, after about a year or so, when the flesh decomposes, you gather the bones and put it in this receptacle, and that's where they stay. Sometimes of an individual, sometimes of a family. Now, what's interesting is that this custom, and we know from Mark, we have about 2,500 of such ossuaries found in Jerusalem. I mean, it was everywhere. It was in all parts of the city, all kinds of burial places, from the fanciest to the most simple. Priests and high priests were buried as such, as well as common folk. It really swept the city. It started in the time of Herod. It peaked and it disappeared after the destruction of the Second Temple. And it was so rooted during these 130 years or so that there were even religious customs that we know about from rabbinic literature that they used to do. It used to be a half, you know, quasi-mourning, mourning, M-O-U-R, right? Ceremony. People, you would tear your garment for the second, it's called secondary burial as well. You would have a sudat havra'ah, a meal after doing it that would be prepared by neighbors and friends, just like you would after a funeral. In other words, it got religious connotation. The question is, where did it come from? And this is a fascinating thing. At this period, Romans were using this for secondary burial as well, although their secondary burial was very different. When someone died in Rome, just as in Greece, what would happen? What would happen after death? Funeral. Well, cremation. Cremation. But then they would gather the remnants and the ashes into what we know about urns because of English poetry. Urns were used, but also these receptacles were used. This was widespread. Now, that's very different what the Jews did. But the basic idea of a secondary burial and putting the remains is very, very similar. And the Roman connection, while it's difficult to really solidly prove it, it makes a great deal of sense because of when it started and when it ended. It started under Herod, when lots of customs from the outside world and practices and architecture and art, etc., were being adopted in Jewish society. And it ended after Jerusalem was destroyed and there was no more center, etc. So it's not only some of the outside buildings, it's also in burial customs, this kind of thing. By the way, if it surprises you that the Jews, when it comes to burial, which is very holy and very special, they would adopt things from the outside, we have evidence from this, from a non-Jew. Evidence from a non-Jew. There's a person, a Greek ethnographer, who lived in the Hellenistic period, Hecataeus from the city of Abdera. And he wrote that the Jews have very unique customs in many ways, but there are two areas that are especially salient in that the Jews borrowed from the world around them. One was the marriage, and the other was burial. All right? And this seems to express, as we have many other cases, of Jewish burial being an adaptation of things that were done on the outside. I don't want to get into the first half, but just know for future use that the ketubah, to the best of our knowledge, was an appropriation of Egyptian demotic, Egyptian custom in the second century BCE and changed for Jewish purposes, but its origins, and this is attested in rabbinic literature itself, was from the outside. So, just to summarize, what I think we see if we open up all the avenues, all the information possible, we see that however one judges Herod, and it's as hard to judge Herod as it is to judge Bush and to judge Kerry. All right, there are lots of different opinions, and it depends what you want to emphasize, and it depends what aspect, but all I'm saying is that no one today half responsible can get away with a generalization of a generation ago. That the guy was totally bad, and he was just bloodthirsty, and that's it. And the archaeological evidence, as well as the other approaches that I noted, indicate that a lot more balance has to be struck. Whatever one's final opinion is of the man, he innovated greatly. He built for the good of the people, as well as himself, and he had a vision. And that vision was a vision of integration, of cooperation. And it was because the Jews, some Jews, rejected that vision. And they pushed for a confrontation against Rome that within 70 years of his death, there was a revolt against Rome And the Jews paid very, very heavily for that. They went up against the great power of the day, and they didn't have a chance. So that there was rejection of his vision that led to very drastic and dire consequences, by the way, which is very kind of fitting today, because in 3 weeks from today is Tisha B'Av, where we talk about the destruction of the temple. As a matter of fact, today is also a minor fast day, the 17th of Tammuz, which is the day, at least from the first temple period, the breaching of the city, and the end was very clear, and that has been institutionalized in our tradition as a day of a minor fast leading up to Tisha B'Av. Okay, let's go to the second example. That was a case of archaeology revolutionizing our understanding of an issue, a chapter in Jewish history that everybody thought they knew. And suddenly, the new information has led to some very, very different evaluations of Herod. Now we come to something that is a tabula rasa. In the year 1918, as a result of during the First World War, as the British were moving up the Euphrates against the Turks, there were lines drawn at a certain point, and a Turkish shell fell near the British lines, and it revealed a temple, or the walls of a temple, not known at all, in the desert, covered by sand. All right? And after the war, they came and began excavating, and they found a whole city called Dura Europus. Dura is the Semitic name, and it later it became a Greek city, and it was called Europus, which is Europa was a place in Macedonia where Seleucid I came from. And this place was excavated intensively between in the 1920s to 1938. And as I said, a whole city that had been lost for 2,000 years almost came to light. Much of it has been published, not everything. They found some 16 pagan temples, other institutions, we'll call it secular civic institutions. They, by the way, found the earliest church. Right? The early Christians used to meet in homes, but the earliest church building ever found anywhere was found at Dura Europus, and it was dated to the year 232, and they found nearby a magnificent synagogue. This place was destroyed in 256. It had been under Roman hands. The Persians from the east, the Sasanian Empire, conquered it in 256, leveled the city, but they abandoned the city. And then the sands took over, and that's why a lot remains. Now, what was unique about this synagogue, of which no other synagogue, and here I'm passing around several things that you can see. What was unbelievable was that the walls of the synagogue from floor to ceiling were full of art, stories of the Bible. Stories of the Bible. Take a look at this here, this thing that you have here on the back side of the page you were looking at. The very top tells you what was found on the western wall. Don't forget the western wall of Dura Europus faced Jerusalem. It was the most important wall. That's why you have this niche in the middle, which is for the Torah, the Torah shrine. All right. So if you take a look on the right, there's a scene, or our right, Samuel anointing David. If you look to the first and further right, the infancy of Moses, all right, finding of Moses. If you look to the left of that Torah shrine, the triumph of Mordechai and Esther, story from Elijah, and other things. Everything around was stories of the Bible except the central part above the Torah shrine, where you had some other things, the blessings of Joseph and Jacob, and four huge figures about whom I will talk in just a minute. It's stunning, and it goes around the other walls. The other walls are not as well preserved as the western wall, but they are to a great extent. It's amazing. It's amazing. How does a small Jewish community living in really the very eastern frontier of the Roman Empire, where do they get this from? Where do they get this art? What does it mean, first of all? Is there any rhyme or reason to all of these pictures? Is there a theme? Two themes. Is there a theme for each register? Is it just a series of things with no particular order? And those are questions that have been argued by scholars for the last 70 years. But everybody agreed, up until 10 years ago, that this must be the tip of the iceberg. It's impossible to assume that this community that maybe existed for a generation or two could have come up with this iconography, with this pictorial model that you see. It must have been throughout the diaspora. It must have been well known. They must have used copy books, pattern books, which we know existed, in order to do what they did. The only problem is that 70 years have gone by. They found this synagogue in 1932 in the course of excavations. 72 years have gone by, and it's still the tip of the iceberg. And lots of synagogues have been found. And so where is the rest of that iceberg? And why aren't we finding it? And that's led a number of scholars to what seemed such an improbable alternative. I'm not saying they're right, but in the last 10 years to suggest maybe this was a local creation. Maybe it's not rooted in something diaspora-wide. Maybe it's something unique to this community that they developed, but we'll leave that go for a while. Now, as you can see down at the bottom of the page below this is, again, a poor Xerox replica of how that wall might have looked. But this is where I want you to take your other piece of paper. Okay? The other piece of paper, and this one that's horizontal, not the four figures, but this one. I wanted to bring this to indicate to you that it goes far beyond a magnificent artistic representation. There are some very basic questions about the Judaism of these people, what they believed, and how widespread that was, or how unique that was. What do you see here?
A wedding under a canopy.
A wedding under a canopy. That's cute. What else is it possible, all right?
Oh. I see a baby.
A baby. A baby. All right, Susan sees a baby. And does anybody want to put this together?
Hey,
I'll give you a hint. It goes from right to left.
Life cycle.
It's the story of human life.
Human life, someone says. Okay. Let's stick with the Bible.
Moses.
The finding of Moses. Let's start on the right. The gate that you see in the city, that represents Egypt. The king is sitting under the canopy. You may think it's a chatan.
Pharaoh.
It's a king.
Okay.
It's not. And the chatan is a king for a day.
Right.
But that's about it. All right? And then he has two servants. And then you have two women. What would two women be standing facing the king? Who are they?
The
midwives. And who's going? What's the name of the midwives?
Shifra
and
Pua.
Very good. And what's the woman doing in front of Shifra and Pua?
Bowing.
Where that, but underneath there is a river. She's putting something in the river. Who could be putting something in the river?
Moses'
mother. Yocheved is putting Moses in the river so he can float down and escape death. And then you have on the left a number of women standing on the side, on the shore, and one woman goes in and she's holding a baby in her left hand. Her right hand is held up here in kind of triumph. Next to her is what in the water?
A teva,
an ark, a basket. It looks fancy. It's the way the Romans would do a teva, you know, something with nice architecture and something like this. And she's going to hand the baby up to the woman above her to the side. Now, this is clearly the finding of Moses. All right? This is Exodus chapter 1 and chapter 2. What's the problem? No, you're not supposed to write on that. You're supposed to pass. Pass, okay? Okay. All right. That's fine. That's fine. All right, that's a wonderful story. There's something very interesting here. This woman on the left standing in the river with her right hand raised in triumph, holding the baby, right? This is a well-known Greek Roman, Greco-Roman model of a goddess, Aphrodite, oh, in the East, Anahita, when she finds the Savior King.
Yeah.
And she is depicted, and by the way, in the water. You should know there's a wonderful book out on the death, the birth and death of the hero. The name, it'll come to me in a second, where it shows that this story of Moses, finding of Moses, was well known in the ancient Near East, used by lots of people, finding of the king, finding in the water, having been kind of not thrown away, abandoned, and saved for a great purpose. So that's what we have. She's naked. She is stark, raving, naked, as she stands there, as she's always depicted in Greco-Roman art. Now comes an interesting question, to go beyond just the pictorial. Why did they do this? There's two levels. Did they show this because that was just a convenient motif that everybody knew about? You could easily copy it. They wanted to show Bat Paro, right? Pharaoh's daughter, finding. So they used the Anahita Aphrodite image in Finding of Moses because that's what was around. Could be something deeper. And what is that?
Touching deity?
Is it possible that the Jewish community viewed Moses in that way, as a kind of a savior, as a kind of a almost supernatural figure, who was then to save Israel in the past and maybe has a role to play in this? In other words, what were they borrowing? Just the superficial representation or the meaning as well? Interesting question. If you think that's a wild idea, you should know that there are a lot of groups in the ancient world who did view Moses as something superhuman. The pagans very often viewed Moses in that way. The Samaritans saw Moses as a kind of savior, and perhaps some diaspora Jewish communities as well, so that this is not a wild idea that doesn't exist. It exists. Question is this also an expression of an idea that we find in other places as well? So let's take a look, finally, at those four figures that appear over the ark. Okay? And it's astounding. I mean, this is not a story. These are four huge figures that dominate the western wall of the synagogue. All right? The one on the right is the easiest. It's a person standing barefoot. You can see his shoes off to our left. And there's a bush there. And who is that?
Moses.
And in case you have any doubt, and you can't see this, but you take my word for it, between his legs is written Moses. All right? By the way, a number of these, not all, a number of these do identify what you see. But that's it. Okay? I have just told you the only one that's certain. All right, now let's see what we can do. On the left is a person, barefoot,
with his shoes.
With shoes, and it looks like a kind of a mountain in the back. Who's that?
Elijah.
What do you know about barefoot and a mountain?
Elijah. Could be Moses.
Could be Moses.
Moses.
Could be Moses again and Sinai. All right, although in Sinai it doesn't say specifically, does it? Shalna lecha. It does say it specifically. Okay. Who else could it be? No, that was in the snare. I'm not sure. All right, let's take a look. Who else was told to remove, besides Moses in the bush, who else is told to remove? Who? No. But you got the first letter right. All right? Who? In English. Actually, it's in Hebrew too. Yud. Yud. Anybody? Joshua. Joshua, before the walls of Jericho, was told to take off his shoes, because he's standing on holy ground. So, this could be Moses, could be Joshua. Down on the right, below, is a person reading a scroll, and below, near his feet, it looks like a teva, some kind of a box or chest that exists there. Okay, who could that be?
Ezra.
Could be Ezra, right? Reads a scroll.
There's a nice cross there.
Right, it's Jesus.
Nice cross, could be, all right. Ezekiel, why Ezekiel?
He's barefoot too.
Well, I don't know if he's swallowing that. He's going, yeah, okay. Who reads? I think we have to go, let's go with the simple thing. Who else reads? Jeremiah read the deed. and chapter 34, before, you know, as a deed of ownership, as a statement that the Jews will come back to Eretz Yisrael, etc. That's the second. Which king found a book and read it? Yoshiyahu, Josiah, 622, probably the book of Deuteronomy was found. Maybe it's even written then. Well, going into that, and he read from that, and of course could be, go back to our Moses. Could be Moses reading when he, in Deuteronomy, reciting reading the laws, etc. It's a possibility. And on the left bottom, also, a man, you can see, emphasized his white hair, emphasized by the black background. There's a sun and moon, or moon and star, whatever they are, maybe sun and moon, above him. His hands are folded, they're covered in kind of a prayer, Oran's posture of prayer. Who could that be?
Moses.
Could be Moses. Could be Moses. Who else?
Aaron,
we don't know. Very good. Who said that? Very good. Could be Joshua. When Joshua in chapter 11, when he didn't quite finish the battle, it was getting dark. Yeah, today we turn on the lights. We have all kinds of electrical, what is it they use in Iraq to find night vision and stuff. But Joshua had a much simpler way. You don't need that. You just tell God to stop the sun. You know, Shemesh begivon dom v'yarech v'emek ayalon. Stop nature and give me another few hours to do the job. Much easier, much easier. So that could be Joshua. It also could be Abraham, who under the stars prayed for a son, and was told that you will have a son, descendants like the stars, also a possibility. In other words, to be honest with you, the three of the four are up for grabs, but I do want to call your attention that one suggestion is that all of these are Moses. And if it goes, if, right, goes together with the finding of Moses and that Anahita Aphrodite posture is half serious, if not fully serious, then you may have an interesting example of a Jewish congregation not only being very, very creative in using art, but having a message of Judaism that we don't find in the Talmud, and we don't find in other remains, and archaeology here is slowly peeling away a lot of the unknowns of the far-flung diaspora and some of the secrets that it holds vis-a-vis Jewish life at that time. So, just to conclude what we've been talking about, with Herod, we have the information that has been accumulating at a tremendous rate over the last 100 years, indicating a different dimension of the person, especially in the public sphere, especially as a leader, and that has to be factored in to the sources, which are generally, not all, but are generally very negative toward him. It may not necessarily be accurate, these sources, but somewhat unfair, and therefore the archaeological material gives us a different perspective. And with Dura, we have a whole new world. A whole new world, which unfortunately, and maybe it is fortunate, has raised more questions than has answered, but it's now out there and has to be dealt with if we want to understand the totality of Jewish life at this time. And therefore, my parting words to you after five, six wonderful days is that because we have so limited sources, you know, the difference between a modern historian and an ancient is the modern historian has so many sources, he'll sink, he'll drown, or he or she, unless you can define your subject in such a way that it's doable, because there's just so much to do. That is a blessing or a curse of too much. In ancient period, it's exactly the opposite. It's a question of starvation and not plenty. There's so little. There's just so little when it comes to specific, with all the sources we have. And the idea is how you put material together imaginatively, creatively, responsibly, in order to tell a story. And in this situation of so little material, archaeology has a fantastic role to play because it keeps pouring in more and more information. And this just expands our knowledge, expands our insight, expands our perspective, and allows us to tell a much more, much fuller and more credible story. So if we have the written sources, which have the problem of being tendentious, with archaeology we have what existed. That you can't quite, that existed. What it meant is another. How widespread? That's another question. But at least we have some solid material to deal with in trying to reconstruct the Jewish past, the past of the Jewish people, and the past of Judaism in that 1,000 years that we call antiquity. Thank you very much.
Do we have time for questions?
Yes, let's have some questions. But just ask to keep the question short, and I'll keep my answers short, and we'll be done. One, two, three.
Short one. Oh, my turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there two other examples of Jewish representation art? One at the Zodiac, the
Bay? Yeah, but we discussed these in previous days. Oh, there are a lot of more, but nothing like this. Sure there are. Yeah, there's the Beit Alpha, there's Hamad Feria, there's Tzipori, you know, mosaic floors, that, definitely, we discussed that. I'm not saying it's the only example of Jewish art, that's not what I said. But this is the most dramatic, overwhelming, and extensive. That I'm willing to, yes?
When you're looking at, quote, normative Judaism at that time.
Right.
Wouldn't a single finding like this be an example of an offshoot? If you were excavating in Irvine and found a messianic Jewish synagogue here, you would, might assume, and that's the only one you found, that there are no other sects in Irvine except this one that considers Christ one of the things.
Right.
What I'm saying to you is this, couldn't this be as much that kind of offshoot trying to be a...
Look, it certainly is an option. It is an offshoot. The only thing I will, and I'm sorry you weren't with us for a few days. I understand you were, but what I tried to do in various ways, and I think that this is where scholarship is going, is to question the term normative. Whereas people used to think that there was a normative Judaism, and this is the great contribution of archaeology and of Goodenough and a number since the mid-20th century. People always talked about a normative Judaism. The Pharisees were the normative Judaism of the Second Temple period. The rabbis were the normative Judaism of the post-70 period. What archaeology and a few other things as well has shown us that we may not have a normative Judaism at this period. Maybe, you know something? Like America. What is normative in America? Is it Reconstruction? Is it conservative? Is it reform? Is it Orthodox? Is it secular? Is it assimilated? What's normative? I don't know. It's not clear to me. But I'm suggesting that what we may, that there was a normative Judaism that emerged in the early Middle Ages, and we call it Rabbinic Judaism, no question. But that's hundreds of years later in very different historical circumstances. It's not clear what there was here. So I think you're absolutely right. You have to be very careful when you have a find like this, how much you generalize. What is it, what's the statement? To generalize is to paralyze. Okay? And it's terrific to be specific. Okay? You have to be careful about generalizing. But in any case, at this point, I would say that I would leave the normative aside a little bit, because that definitely has come into question how much there was. The only normative thing we know of the Second Temple period is that there was a temple. And the overwhelming majority of Jews saw the temple as the most sacred site in the world for them. And many got there more often, and some got there less often. But there's not a lot of other normativeness. I mean, you could talk about one God, that certainly was. The sanctity of the Torah, that certainly was. The sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, that was as well. But you can't go too much beyond that in terms of our information. And there's a lot beyond those four things or five things that I spoke about. Susan?
I just wanted to know, where in Turkey is Dura Europa?
It's not. It's in Syria.
Oh, Syria.
Syria. It's the eastern end of Syria, the border of Iraq, on the Euphrates River. On the Euphrates River. Any other? Yes, sir.
Do we know the period where this synagogue, the Dula synagogue, was functioning?
Yes. Everything was destroyed. Yes, very good. The whole city was destroyed, including the synagogue, in 256. The synagogue that you see here was built in 244. It existed for 12 years. Now, before this synagogue, before this fully decorated, there was an earlier stage of the synagogue that ended in 244 when they enlarged the synagogue, okay? We don't know when that earlier one began. The best guess is somewhere around 200. So we're talking about the first half of the 3rd century is when the Jewish community was there, built synagogue, and in 244 they built the synagogue that we saw here.
In Beit HaTfutzot?
Yes. Nachon, Beit HaTfutzot. A replica, right.
We don't have time. One more question, and then we're going to be
yes.
wrapping it up.
You said the church was built in around 232?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Church, that's okay.
That was a good question. Okay.
Can we anticipate the Levine Code as the next work?
I wish.
Okay, let me just say a few quick remarks before we say goodbye and farewell and shalom to Professor Levine. The first thing is just more of a question or a point. It seems to me, talking about monolithic understanding, given that I had a very parochial Jewish education for 12 years, it was always my understanding when people look back on Jewish history, they always thought the Jews as being living separately, you know, within the Roman Empire, but it's very much separate, creating their own traditions. What you've shown us through the six lectures is how, and this is maybe a question that can't be answered, how Judaism looked at the surrounding societies, incorporated what it wanted to adapt and adopt so that Judaism could thrive and continue as a religion. My question is, was it the rabbis, were the leaders of the community doing it, or was it the lay people that were interacting daily with the society around it that brought it back, forcing the rabbis to then incorporate? So that was just a question. I don't know if you can answer that one. Whatever the answer is, obviously there was a lot of interaction going on, because just for yesterday's discussion about the Seder and how it followed the symposium meant that someone had to be at a symposium, and someone had to take that idea and discuss it with the rabbis or with the community, had to be adopted.
I'll do it very briefly. There are no rabbis in Dura Europus. Right? No, when you want to take a look at Jewish society in its totality,
for leaders, is it?
There were rabbis in two places, in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Two places, in Babylonia, of which we have no archaeological remains, and the Galilee. Okay? All the rest of Jewish communities got along, functioned liturgically, functioned communally, to the best of our knowledge, without rabbinic involvement. So that's a perspective to bear in mind. If you ask the question, in the Galilee, and in Babylonia, were they the movers and shakers? That's part of the normative question that you asked, which today there are. It is a very basic question that is being disputed among scholars. And if I speak for myself, and I think the majority, as of now, tend to assume a much less official and public rabbinic posture and control and influence over the Jewish community at large. Much of what we see in archaeology are communities that created for themselves. I don't think I mentioned this, but I'll end with one story. But never do this. I have some friends who are rabbis, so please do not. There was a rabbi who was functioning in a synagogue in a place called Tarbanat, which is near Afula. And he was translating. Remember I told you the Jews didn't understand Hebrew. So you read the Torah, and someone had to translate to Aramaic or to Greek. This was probably Aramaic. And the people asked him, don't translate verse by verse. Do half verses so we can tell our children what you're saying. And he said, no, the halakha says verse by verse. And they insisted half. So he went back to his teacher, Rabbi Hanina, and he said, what do I do? And Rabbi Hanina said, and I'm sure this is a dramatic exaggeration, that if they cut off your head, you do it the way you've learned. He went back and translated verse by verse, and the next day he was fired. That's where the power lay in the community. I think that story is worth 1,000. And that's why when I tell students in Israel, if you want to understand the Jewish community, I said this before a few days ago, the synagogue. Go see how a synagogue functions in diaspora, not in Israel, because in Israel it's controlled from above. The same thing I would say with the status of the rabbis. You want to understand where the power lay in antiquity, vis-a-vis decisions that have to do with the synagogue and all its aspects, there is the example and not some papal authority that's given down and had to be followed. That is a nutshell. It requires expansion.
Thank you. Thank you very much.